Is looking through the book of Nehemiah, and we've got the overarching theme for the year of being open to God, and this particular series says open to God through serving, that as we serve the Lord wherever we are and however whatever it is that he's called us to do, we will find ourselves open to God, and may we be open to God in the acts of serving. We've given this the title So Far So Good. And we'll be reading that passage, or most of it, in a few minutes. In the early 1980s, a young Australian missionary was trying without success to help desperately poor farmers in Niger to overcome the effects of soil degradation. This is him, a few years later. 4 or 5 times a year, they'd sow crops, only to see them overcome by sand drifts. They repeatedly attempted to plant trees in the hope of stabilizing the soil and retaining water and providing shade, but it repeatedly failed because the trees just died. Tony Ronaldo, who now works internationally for World Vision, prayed in desperation. And a national newspaper carried this story just a couple of years ago and quoted him. He prayed. And then said, I saw for the first time what had been there all along. Seemingly useless small bushes scattered over the dry land, which we had despised as weeds, were actually the outward signs of a vast underground forest. The bushes were, in fact, clumps of shoots growing from the roots of trees that had been cut down years before, but were actually still alive and drawing life from far beneath the arid soil. What was happening was that whenever they grew, they'd either get cut back or they'd get eaten by livestock. So what Tony Ronaldo did was to protect them from the animals and prune them to a single stem, and within a few years had seen healthy trees grow up and healthy harvests too. It's now known as farmer-managed natural regeneration. Farmer-managed natural regeneration. And the results have been staggering. Over 200 million trees, 200 million trees, covering 5 million hectares, enough extra grain to feed 2.5 million people, and that's just in Niger. The technique's been exported to neighbouring countries, redeeming land, supporting crops, reducing poverty, and even, it's believed, helping to combat climate change. I love this story. I love it for all sorts of reasons. Firstly, because I think it's just such a cracking good news story, isn't it? When you hear about poverty and desertification and all the rest of it, to hear how someone has found this simple organic technique, and I think that's the other thing I love about it. It's just low-tech. It's natural. It doesn't demand anything beyond caring for what is there. But without taking anything away from the environmental point of the story, it also says to me something about the importance of roots. Maybe it's just me, but I love history. I have a very strong sense of belonging where I'm from, which, as many of you know, is Bromsgrove. I love folk music and classical music, which, although they're continually developing and being adapted and built on and everything else, essentially are all about the roots, where they come from, understanding the tradition in order that things may grow and develop. I think there are lots and lots of spiritual lessons we could draw out from this story of Tony Ronaldo and the farmer-managed natural regeneration, including, I believe, the truth that anything of lasting value in this life is likely to be deeply rooted. Anything of lasting value in this life is likely to be deeply rooted. People who make a positive difference in the world are people who choose not to live superficially. They have depth. They put down roots. They have something worth living for beyond themselves. They have a cause, a purpose, a reason for living. And it doesn't have to be some great thing like millions of trees. It could, in fact, involve the dedicated care of one person, or a family, or a small community, or whatever it might be. Teresa of Calcutta, when she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979, said, if only each of us could remember, God loves me. And I have an opportunity to love others as he loves me, not in big things, but in small things with great love. not in big things necessarily, but in small things with great love. The story also reminds me not to neglect what is there in front of me, what is there in front of us, and in fact, what is there in front of me this morning as I look at you. Many of you will know Eugene Peterson from his translation of the Bible, which we know as The Message, paraphrase translation, whichever you prefer. But he's written a number of books on pastoral ministry. And one in particular I read just before I went to Bristol Baptist College. And I hope that what he wrote there has continued to inform and shape my ministry over the past 20 years. He wrote this: "Why do pastors so often treat congregations with the impatience and violence of developers building a shopping mall instead of the patient devotion of a farmer cultivating a field? The shopping mall will be abandoned in disrepair in 50 years. The field will be healthy and productive for another 1,000 if its mysteries are respected by a skilled farmer. The congregation is not the enemy. Pastoral work is not adversarial. These people in the pews, or in our case chairs, are not aliens to be conquered, defeated, and then rehabilitated to the satisfaction of the pastoral ego. The congregation is topsoil, seething with energy and organisms that have incredible capacities for assimilating death and participating in resurrection. The only biblical stance is awe. When we see what is before us, really before us, pastors take off their shoes before the glory of congregation." As I said, those words have, I hope, informed and shaped my ministry and certainly challenged me at times when the pastoral ego has been bruised. I believe the story also may give us the key to understanding how we respond to the challenge of changing times. Because there's no doubt we live in changing and challenging times, just as Nehemiah did, just as our forebears did, those who began this church 350 years ago, 1666 and all that. The title we've given today is So Far, So Good, because after 52 days of work, the entire wall was finished on the 25th day of the month of Elul. When our enemies in the surrounding nations heard this, they realized that they had lost face, since everyone knew that the work had been done with God's help. During all this time, the Jewish leaders had been in correspondence with Tobiah, that's the Ammonite official whose nose was seriously put out of joint by Nehemiah coming and rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. Many people in Judah were on his side because of his Jewish father-in-law, Shechaniah, son of Arah. In addition, his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, son of Berechiah. People would talk in front of me about all the good deeds Tobiah had done, and would tell him everything I said, and he kept sending me letters to try to frighten me. And now the wall had been rebuilt. The gates had all been put in place, and the temple guards, the members of the sacred choir, and the other Levites had been assigned their work. I put two men in charge of governing the city of Jerusalem, my brother Hanani and Hananiah, commanding officer of the fortress. Hananiah was a reliable and God-fearing man without an equal. I told them not to have the gates of Jerusalem opened in the morning until well after sunrise and to have them closed and barred before the guards went off duty at sunset. I also told them to appoint guards from among the people who lived in Jerusalem and to assign some of them to specific posts and others to patrol the area round their own houses. Jerusalem was a large city, but not many people were living in it and not many houses had been built yet. God inspired me to assemble the people and their leaders and officials and to check their family records. I located the records of those who had first returned from captivity. That was about 80 years before Nehemiah's writing. And this is the information I found. Many of the exiles left the province of Babylon and returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own city. Their families had been living in exile in Babylonia ever since King Nebuchadnezzar had taken them there as prisoners, which was 70 years before that. Their leaders were Zerubbabel, Joshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Ramiah, Nahamani, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mispereth, Bigvai, Nehum, and Bana. And I hope those will forgive me for mispronouncing their names, which I undoubtedly did. The secret is to say it with confidence, because most people don't know how you're supposed to pronounce them either. Nehemiah goes on to list the names of the clans of Israel who had returned previously. I'm not going to read all their names, not because it's boring and unimportant, but because it's going to take a long time and I shall really trip up if I try and be that clever. But their names are recorded. They're there in the archives, and the names of the people are there because they're part of the story of which we now find ourselves a part. This is our family history, our spiritual family history, and they're there for a reason, to remind us of the importance of individuals in the story of God. There are some who couldn't prove their ancestry effectively, and as a result, the decision is made to not allow them to be involved in any of the priestly work and to be a bit cautious about them until such time as the worshipping life of the nation is re-established. There's a reference here to until there was a priest who could use the Urim and Thummim. Nobody actually knows what the Urim and Thummim are, but we read about them in the Old Testament. And they were a way in which priests somehow discerned what God's will was. So what they're basically saying is just wait until we've got things sorted out and we've got someone who can actually discern what your place is among us. The people then contribute, bringing gold, bowls, robes for the priests, and silver. And Nehemiah himself sets the tone by being very generous in what he brings into the worshipping life and into the national treasury, if you like. And the priests and the Levites and the temple guards, the musicians, many of the ordinary people, the temple workmen, all the people of Israel settled in the towns and cities of Judah. In other words, they left some of the places where they had settled and came to be part of the rebuilding and the rejuvenation of the capital city. So far, so good. Nehemiah's memoirs highlight what we've referred to a number of times during this series as his visionary and strategic leadership. But they also point to what I said when we began the series about this servant heart that he had. Here was someone for whom prayer was at the heart of all he did. And although Nehemiah could be assertive at times, he also shied away from abusing his position and elevating himself above those he governed. You may remember in a previous passage how he didn't have all that he was entitled to in terms of food and all the rest of it when he could have done. Through it all, Nehemiah pays tribute to God. God who inspired him, God who guided him, and God who provided for him so that this great task could be completed. Against all the odds, this war's been finished. Praise God is what he says. I wonder if you might have quoted from Psalm 23. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So far, so good. Yet the work goes on. As did the subtle attempts of Nehemiah's enemies to undermine him and get him to get off course. During all this time, it says, chapter 6, verse 17, there is subtle opposition going on. It came in the form of spiritual manipulation by those who claim to be God's prophets, and the machinations of self-interested ruling elite hedging their bets and sucking up to the jealous and resentful Tobiah. Isn't it difficult when you can't tell friend from foe? When you don't know who to trust, who's really on your side, or when people do things behind your back, or when people don't do what is right and leave you feeling vulnerable and betrayed. Tobiah seems to have been organizing trading alliances with some of Judah's nobles, who kept trying to present him in a favorable light to Nehemiah. And mixed up in all of this, there were marriage alliances that threatened to undermine the wholehearted commitment needed to see the life of Jerusalem and the worship of God reestablished. Subtle temptations and attempts to steer us off course, which is what Nehemiah was facing, are often more difficult to face than outright opposition. And we can get swept along, can't we? Unwittingly losing sight of God and his way for our lives. But Nehemiah wasn't swayed. And he goes about the next phase of the work, which is to establish gatekeepers, or in this translation that I read, temple guards. And a sacred choir, the singers, the musicians who would lead the people in worship, and the Levites. The guards were posted to protect citizens from violent attack, but also to protect them from infiltration by those who might compromise their attempts to rebuild the moral and spiritual life of the city. The singers led the people in the worship of God. And worship was absolutely vital, as it is for us. Because it was in worship that the people were reminded of the purpose of their lives. It was the way in which they regained confidence in their faith and new forgiveness. And it was where they were given hope when times were tough. They had their sights lifted up to focus on what was best, not on what was expedient and convenient. What does God really want from you? And that was reestablished every time they gathered for worship. The Levites, the tribe of Levi, was one of the 12 ancient tribes of Israel, from which all the priests were chosen. And it seems that after the exile in Babylon, they had a key role in teaching and interpreting scripture, a tradition that we follow today in making the sermon an integral part of the service we offer to God in worship. So, what Nehemiah has done is arranged for physical and moral protection, inspiring worship, and effective teaching. And all those things are put in place so that the people will flourish. And the next task is repopulating the city. And for this, what Nehemiah does is go to the archives. And he finds a list of those who were the first to return about 80 years before. And he asks the families of those who had returned to relocate to Jerusalem so that it could become the spiritual and cultural and economic center that it needed to be. Each one is called to play their part, to take their place wherever it is on the city walls, to bring their gifts and their offerings to the establishment of this new city. Nehemiah was doing something new here, but he was making use of something old, something that was already there. He knew his history, and he delved into the past for a solution to a contemporary challenge. I believe history is important if we're going to make sense of the present and steer a wise course in the future. Maybe I'm biased because that's been my subject over the years, history, but I do believe it's important. You might have come across some of these famous quotes. George Santayana, who's a Spanish philosopher, was the first to say, "Those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it." It's often attributed to Winston Churchill, who may well have said it as well. Hegel, the German philosopher, "The only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history." And Theodore Roosevelt said, "The more you know about the past, the better prepared you are for the future." The Christian poet Steve Turner put it this way, "History repeats itself. It has to. Nobody listens." Throughout the Bible, we are reminded to remember. We are reminded to remember. Throughout the Old Testament, remember the Exodus, particularly that great deliverance from Egypt and the 40 years in the wilderness and the covenant that God established with his people. And the words of the prophets throughout the Old Testament essentially are saying, remember the covenant. Remember who you are and who you are called to be as the people of God. And in the New Testament, Jesus said, remember me this way through the bread and through the wine. Remember especially his death on the cross for us, but all that Jesus said and did, and that he is with us now, risen from the dead. This is not about living in the past, but it's about honoring those who've gone before us. And it's about valuing the past like treasure, so that it might inform and enrich and guide and shape our present, and indeed through that our future. Earlier in the month, Pete Billingham challenged us to recognize that we live in changing times. If you were here then, you may remember his message. And that we, as churches, need to respond to those changing times. It's no good just trying to do business as usual. That was the quote Pete had on the screen, business as usual. I had some illustrations just a couple of days ago, which help us to realize that we do indeed live in changing times, if we needed to be persuaded, not least when it comes to people in our own culture understanding what it is that we're about as Christians. In 2007, Summerfield, supermarket chain that is obviously taken over by Co-op, I think, is that right? Sent out a press release which talked about the millions of pounds that Britons were going to spend in the next few weeks on Easter eggs. And the press release finished by saying that a lot of young people today don't know about the connection between Easter eggs and the birth of Jesus. The birth of Jesus. Somebody obviously wrote in, I think it was a spokesman for the Church of England, pointing out the error. And a hastily revised press release came out a couple of days later, which corrected it as saying the rebirth of Jesus. Finally, 2 days after that, they managed to get it right and had the resurrection of Jesus. But the graduate, someone in their 30s, clearly didn't know themselves what it was that they were writing about. A man attended a creative arts group at a church in Crawley, this one. It was during the week, and he went along for the art group and enjoyed it very much. On one occasion, he saw people coming out of the morning service, and he expressed surprise and inquired what was going on. He said, "Oh, I didn't know people came here on Sundays." Some mothers at a primary school gate in Eastbourne a few years ago met one morning, and one of them looked rather flustered and rather troubled. She explained that as they'd been coming to school, they passed a church building, and outside there was a statue of a man on a cross, and her little boy had said, "Who's that?" And the mother didn't know, and said, "I thought I ought to have known." And amongst the mums she was talking to, only one knew that it was Jesus. A group of school children from the UK were on a trip to Spain to the famous church at, in Barcelona, the Sagrada Familia. Some of you might be familiar with these sort of magic squares, as they're called, these puzzles. Normally, you've got 16 numbers arranged in a square of 4x4, and whichever way you look at it, it adds up to the number 34. This is a little bit different. 10 appears twice, and 14 appears twice, instead of 12 and 16. And 10 and 14 in themselves are significant numbers, biblically speaking. But whichever way you look at it, up, down, across, diagonally, it adds up to 33. And the children were asked if they knew why. It was 33. They had a clue. So it was explained to them that 33 was the age that Jesus was when he died. "That's young," said one of the children. "What did he die of?" A Baptist minister was going abroad and went to buy some foreign currency. I know it's the euro. There's nothing I'm saying by having that on the screen, by the way. It was just the best picture I could find. Buying foreign currency for a trip abroad. And the cashier was rather puzzled and a bit wary, because the minister, who was a woman, said that her first name was Mary. But the documents she showed had the first name Reverend. And it was a Muslim colleague who explained what Reverend meant, and that it was a title, not a first name. How do we respond to this? Is it dreadful? Is it further evidence, if we needed it, that we are no longer a Christian country, whatever that is meant to mean? It's certainly evidence that we can no longer assume people know the story that was familiar to many previous generations. And therefore our mission, our evangelism, cannot start where it's been used to starting, which is essentially saying, "You know the old story, don't you? But you may not have made a personal commitment to Jesus yet." Jesus? Who's Jesus? Might be the response, as opposed to, "Yes, I know all the bits, I just haven't put the jigsaw together yet." Or is this a fantastic opportunity? Someone I was listening to the other day said, "We have the opportunity for the first time in a very, very long time to tell the story of Jesus to people who've never heard it before." As you would if you went to a part of the world where he had not been proclaimed. But it challenges us to think, how on earth do we therefore live out our Christian faith? How do we communicate? What will work and what won't? And I'd argue that a historical perspective can help us enormously as we seek to get our bearings and steer a wise course in how we live out our lives as a disciple-making community. And that's what a church is. A disciple-making community. Few of us like change, do we? And I'm not looking anywhere, Maureen. Few of us like change. But it's often said that change is here to stay. And one of the important lessons of history is that change is nothing new. And what's more, it's not always good, and it's not always bad. And I think we have to recognize that and be discerning. It's no good just rushing after whatever is the latest thing because it's new and therefore better. It might not be. And one of the difficulties that our society is currently facing is that the amount of choice and change and everything is actually leading to more and more mental health issues. I think I'm probably right there, doctor. Whether that's the only reason is another matter. But the breakup of family life, and so it goes on. And change is all around us and difficult to handle, and people can't cope with it. But on the other hand, I wouldn't have wanted to live 100 years ago when my three sons would have possibly been at the Battle of the Somme. 150 years ago, average life expectancy in this country was about 50. So I would be considered an old man. No comments, please. And our forebears here in Bromsgrove Baptist Church, 1666 and all that, they lived at a time of extraordinary change. And as Baptists, they were not in the majority. They were not part of the system of power of church and state. They were a persecuted, or at least by that stage, a tolerated, reluctantly tolerated minority without the same rights as everybody else in society. Go back 50 years before that and they would have been actively persecuted for their faith and some put to death because they didn't fit in. That's part of our heritage. But they were calling people to be disciples of Jesus and finding ways in which they could do that that were relevant for their day and age. I'd love to illustrate what I mean about change having always been here and just having that perspective that perhaps prevents us from being too preoccupied with coping with it all in our own day and age. We could say a lot about this, but let me just sketch a few things in. For roughly 1,000 years, say from the 5th to the 15th centuries, people's lifestyles didn't actually change an awful lot. They were vulnerable, very prone to disease and whatever was going on politically and militarily. But basically it was agriculture and trying to eke out a living from the land and all the rest of it. And people didn't travel much and so on. But at the start of the 16th century, and what historians refer to as the modern period, change happened incredibly rapidly. The invention of the printing press might seem old-fashioned to us, and when you look at these great clunky things, you think, my goodness, how on earth did they make books out with those? But it meant hundreds and thousands of articles and books could be printed very easily and quickly and passed around and spread, whereas before everything had to be written by hand on parchment or vellum. Copernicus asserted that the earth was not the center of the universe and blew apart the medieval view of how things were. Absolutely mind-boggling for people who lived back then. We had the birth of modern science, sailing ships that could go on great long sea voyages that enabled exploration but also conquest and colonization. And feudalism, which had been the norm for centuries, gave way to market capitalism. And the Protestant Reformation denied the authority of the Roman Catholic Church, leading to a counter-reformation and religious conflict, and new expressions of church, like Baptists. Massive amount of change. Some people talk about a postmodern period, a transitional period perhaps from the 1950s onwards. The printing press may look old-fashioned now, as we have information technology and the internet, and a mind-boggling amount of information can be spread around the world in seconds. A global economy, e-commerce, and new science that actually challenges the way in which the universe has been seen for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. That maybe it's not as mechanistic and static as perhaps people used to think. Psychology has changed the way we understand ourselves. It's fascinating if you read some of the work of the psychologists in the 20th century to realize just what an impact they've had on our normal everyday language, how we talk about ourselves, how we're feeling. I feel a bit depressed. Well, depressed, what on earth did that mean before Freud, you know, or people like him? Developments in society like secularism and materialism, the decline of institutional religion, and so on. And Christian responses today vary. Perhaps two examples. One will be what we call emerging church, where groups of disciples are saying, what does it mean for us to be church here in this place today, to live missionally? Not doing what we've always done, but doing things in a fresh way. Or on the other hand, a retreat into fundamentalism and a reaction. And the reaction is the temptation. I love the picture there, little chap. But the temptation is always to react because we find something threatening. And we either retreat into what is familiar, business as usual, only to find that we fail to connect with the people around us and see the church wither and die. Do you know the seven last words of a dying church? Do you know? Yeah, it's that we have always done it this way. Or we react differently by trying desperately to appear relevant, jumping on the latest bandwagon that promises success for our church, buying all the latest kit, chasing after every new opportunity, only to find that we wear ourselves out in a frantic effort to keep up with the times or lose anything distinctive that marks us out as worth knowing. And it brings me back to this story of Tony Ronaldo and his trees, which I said could provide us with the key to understanding how we respond to the challenge of changing times. I think it helps us to see that whether we're sticking to what's familiar or trying to keep up with the times, in the end, they're the same thing. They're both a reaction, not a response. The first reaction, keep planting trees. It's what we've always done. And surely if we keep doing the same thing faithfully and stubbornly year after year, then eventually we'll see what we long for. No, the trees just died because the soil was degraded and couldn't support them. The second reaction, keep planting trees. You just need the latest technology, more fertilizer, more effort. Keep planting trees. No, it's not going to work. Nothing worked, but the solution lay in rediscovering the roots and nurturing the life that was there. The key to understanding how we respond to the challenge of changing times is knowing who we are, to whom we belong, and being rooted in the love of God so that we are able to adapt to changes in our environment and discern what really matters and what can be dismissed and be constantly renewed for the task of God's mission, relying on his strength, his inspiration, and his provision. There's a verse in the Bible which is often quoted when people talk about vision. I have talked about this before, so some of you may know where I'm going with this. Do you know the verse I'm thinking of? When people talk about having a vision, what's the verse they often quote? Anybody help me? Without a vision, the people perish. Proverbs 29, verse 18. I'm sure many of you know it. But actually, if you read that in any translation other than the King James Version, which I've just quoted, you'll be surprised that it doesn't sound anything like that. Without a word from God, without a revelation of God, the people run amok. The people go astray. What it means is that without hearing from God, without knowing who we are and what he is calling us to be and who he's calling us to be, we lose our way. Therefore, the key to understanding how we respond to the challenge of changing times isn't to react. It is to be more and more deeply rooted in the love of God and to realize that that's where our security lies, so that we are able to live out what being a disciple means. And it is quite simply to love God, to love our neighbor, and to love one another. How we do that is going to change as the years go by, but at heart it remains the same, and we discover the vitality that we need by going deep into God. Our verse for the year says, my prayer is that light will flood your hearts and that you will understand the hope that was given to you when God chose you. My prayer is that light will flood your hearts and that you will understand the hope that was given to you when God chose you. Amen. Take a moment to be still.